I want you to close your eyes for a second, just for a moment. Picture the most remote place you can possibly imagine.
Okay.
Maybe it's, I don't know, deep in the Amazon rainforest, or maybe it's the Sahel, all dust and scrubland.
Right.
Or, heck, even a frozen bit of tundra up in northern Canada. Just
yeah.
absolute total isolation.
Right. No roads coming in, no power lines overhead.
No cell towers on the horizon, nothing.
Just you and, well, the wilderness.
Exactly. Just you and the elements. Now imagine you hear a whirring sound and a helicopter comes and drops a standard 40-foot shipping container right in front of you. Lands with this heavy metallic sud.
Mm-hmm.
You walk over, you crack the seal, and you swing open those big heavy doors. And suddenly, inside that metal box, you have, well, you have civilization.
You're not just talking about a generator and some water filters.
Oh, no. I'm talking about power, clean water,
yeah.
high-speed internet connectivity, and even a banking system.
All of it. Self-contained.
All of it. Generating itself. Completely. 100%. Independent of the rest of the world. It sounds like a great survivalist fantasy, right? The kind of thing you see in a movie just before the zombies show up.
It definitely hits on that that prepper instinct that I think a lot of people have these days. But I have a feeling you aren't bringing this up because you're planning an elaborate camping trip.
I wish. That would be a lot less complicated. No, I'm bringing this up because this civilization in a box, it isn't a fantasy anymore.
It's a business plan.
It's a business plan. And according to the stack of documents we are diving into today, it is, in some places, currently operational.
We are talking about Dereticular.
Dereticular. It honestly sounds like a villains corporation from a cyberpunk novel, doesn't it?
It has that ring to it, for sure.
They bill themselves as an industrial infrastructure venture studio, which is a bit of a mouthful. But their pitch deck, their mission statement, it's way more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
They claim to be building the operating system for sovereign infrastructure.
And honestly, looking at the date on these documents, we're in February 2026. The timing for a pitch like that is, well, it's eerily precise.
It really is. I mean, just think about the last 18 months. We've had rolling brownouts in the Northeast. The grid instability down in Texas is practically a monthly tradition at this point, and geopolitical tensions are?
High is an understatement.
Yeah, high is putting it mildly.
The fragility of the whole centralized model has just been laid bare for everyone to see. We sort of took it for granted, but we realized that the global supply chain, the SWIFT banking system, the electrical grid.
They're all dominoes.
They are all massive interconnected dominoes. And if one starts to wobble, everybody, everywhere feels it.
And right in the middle of all this wobbling, you've got the rise of this term, DPIN. The tech world just loves its acronyms.
Decentralized Physical Infrastructure Networks.
It's a mouthful, yeah. But the money flowing into it is incredibly serious. I was looking at some analyst reports. They're projecting a $3.5 trillion market cap for DPIN projects by 2028.
That's a staggering number. And you're seeing it everywhere, right? Decentralized Wi-Fi, decentralized mapping with projects like Helium, decentralized data storage. But Dereticular is trying to do something much, much heavier.
Yeah, this isn't about sharing your Wi-Fi router for a few crypto tokens.
No, they are trying to put a full-blown utility company in a box.
But here is the real twist, and this is what we're going to spend the next hour or so unpacking. Dereticular is in the middle of a massive pivot, a strategic shift.
Right. They started out by building and selling these hardware boxes.
And now they want to be the app store for infrastructure.
Which is a classic Silicon Valley maneuver, if a very risky one. Hardware is hard. It's expensive, low margin. Software. Software is where the recurring revenue is.
But to understand why they're doing this, and more importantly, how they think they can possibly pull it off, we have to go back. We have to look at the theory behind the machine.
The intellectual framework.
Exactly. Because Dereticular isn't just, you know, throwing cool tech at a wall to see what sticks. Their documents are explicit about this. They're trying to operationalize the work of Jeremy Rifkin.
Jeremy Rifkin. Now, there is a name I haven't heard in the boardroom in a long, long time. He's usually discussed in, what, academic circles? Maybe at the European Commission? Not in a venture capital pitch.
I know. It's like finding out a hot new startup is basing their entire business model on Plato's Republic. But they are betting the farm on Rifkin's theory of the third industrial revolution. And this is the key. They're using some brand new regulations that just came into effect, the Genius Act and the Clarity Act, to make it profitable.
This is the convergence we really need to focus on. It's not just about, you know, burning hemp to generate power in a remote village.
No.
It's about how that act of generating power turns into a verifiable, liquid financial asset that someone on Wall Street can actually trade. It's the bridge between heavy, dirty industry and high-speed, clean DeFi.
So settle in. We are going to go from high-minded economic theory down to heavy machinery and finally into the financial plumbing of the future. Let's dive deep into DeReticular.
Let's get into it.
Okay, so to really get what DeReticular is trying to build, we have to understand the playbook they're reading from.
Yeah.
And that's Jeremy Rifkin. You've read his work on the Third Industrial Revolution. Can you break it down for us? What's the core thesis here?
Sure. Rifkin's argument is really fascinating because it sort of simplifies all of economic history into a single repeatable formula. He argues that the great economic revolutions, the ones that completely reshape how the human species lives on the planet, only happen when three very specific technological systems converge at the exact same time.
The big three.
Big three. You need one, a new communication medium, two, a new energy source, and three, a new mode of mobility or logistics.
It sounds almost too simple on the surface, but I imagine the interplay between those three is where the magic happens.
It is. It's the fusion of the three that creates the new economic platform. Think about the first industrial revolution back in the 19th century. What changed?
Well, the big one was steam power.
Coal.
Coal.
Coal-powered steam was the new energy. That was the muscle of the revolution. But you also had the printing press finally reaching steam-powered efficiency, which allowed for mass communication, public schooling, newspapers.
That's the communication layer.
That's the communication layer. And for mobility.
The steam locomotive.
The railroad.
The steam locomotives. So you have coal, print, and trains.
Right.
And that convergence didn't just build factories. It built the modern nation state. It allowed us to organize society vertically, hierarchically. Right. You needed massive amounts of capital to build a railroad, huge amounts of capital to build a coal mine. It created these top-down power structures.
Okay. That makes sense. So what about the second industrial revolution, the one, you know, we all grew up in?
That kicks off in the 20th century. Communication evolves into centralized electronic media, the telephone, the radio, and eventually television.
The energy source moves from coal to centralized oil and the centralized electrical grid. And mobility.
The car.
The internal combustion engine.
A car, exactly. Yep. And that convergence gave us mass consumer culture. It gave us suburbia, the multinational corporation.
Mm-hmm.
But you notice the pattern, right? It's still centralized. You have a few massive oil companies, a few massive TV networks, a few massive car manufacturers controlling everything. It's still a top-down power structure.
And Rifkin's argument is that we're done with that. We are now entering the third industrial revolution.
We aren't just entering it. He would argue we are deep in the messy, chaotic transition phase. The third industrial revolution is all about distributing that power, flipping the pyramid.
So what are the three pillars this time around?
For communication, it's clearly the digital internet. We're talking 5G, satellite constellations like Starlink, the Internet of Things.
The communication is everywhere.
It's everywhere, and it's peer-to-peer. For energy, it's what he calls the energy internet distributed renewables, where every home, every factory, every building becomes its own mini power plant. Okay. And mobility.
The logistics internet. Autonomous electric transport running on a smart grid, all managed by AI.
So instead of one giant power plant serving a million people, you have a million people generating their own power and then sharing the surplus with each other.
Precisely. The entire structure of the economy shifts from vertical and hierarchical to lateral and distributed. And this is what leads to Rifkin's most controversial prediction, the zero marginal cost society.
Zero marginal cost. Now, just as a business concept, that sounds terrifying. If I'm selling widgets, the last thing I want is for the cost and therefore the price to approach zero.
Well, we have to be precise about what marginal cost is. It's the cost of producing one additional unit of a good or service after you've already paid your fixed costs.
Okay.
The classic example is digital media. Think about a song on Spotify. It costs a lot of money to record the album, build the studio. Those are the fixed costs. But once it's uploaded to the server, what does it cost Spotify to stream it to one more listener?
Basically nothing. A fraction of a cent for the data.
It's essentially zero. Rifkin's big idea is that this digital logic is now escaping the screen and moving into the physical world of energy and logistics.
How so?
If you have a solar panel on your roof, the sun is free. Once you've paid for the panel, the marginal cost of generating one more kilowatt hour of electricity is near zero. If you have an autonomous electric truck, the marginal cost of moving a box from A to B is plummeting because there's no driver salary and the electricity is getting cheaper and cheaper.
So we move from a world defined by scarcity to a world of, well, abundance.
Abundance of access, maybe not necessarily ownership. And this is his concept of the collaborative commons. You don't need to own the car. You just need to access the mobility network. You don't need to own the power drill. You just 3D print one when you need it or grab one from a shared tool library.
It's a huge shift in thinking, but there's a darker side to his theory, right? Rifkin isn't just some tech utopian cheerleader. He talks about this thing called the empathy entropy paradox. And honestly, this is the part of his work that really stuck with me.
It's the philosophical anchor of the whole theory. It's a profound observation. Rifkin looks back through history and sees that as our communication technology gets better and more far-reaching, our capacity for empathy expands.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, in our hunter-gatherer days, your empathy was limited to your immediate tribe. You couldn't communicate with anyone else, so you couldn't care about them. Then, with the invention of writing and roads, our identity and empathy expanded to larger groups. We started caring about Christians or the French or the Chinese.
Sort of imagined community.
Exactly. And now, with the internet, we see a video of a flood in Pakistan or a wildfire in Australia in real time, and we feel it. Yeah. We have developed what he calls biosphere consciousness. We empathize with the whole human species and even with the planet itself.
Okay, that makes sense. But here comes the but, the paradox.
The but is entropy, the second law of thermodynamics. It's the unavoidable tax on everything. Mm-hmm. Every time we increase the complexity of our civilization to connect more people and expand our empathy, we have to burn more energy. We consume more resources. We create more waste, more disorder in the biosphere.
So as we get closer to each other emotionally and culturally, we're simultaneously, physically destroying the planet that supports us all.
That is the paradox in a nutshell. The Roman Empire required chopping down the forests of Europe. The Industrial Age required burning the atmosphere. Our empathy is in a race against our own entropy.
And Rifkin presents the Third Industrial Revolution as the way out of this trap.
He believes it's the only way out, because if you can successfully switch to a system of distributed renewables and hyper-efficient automated logistics, you can, for the first time in history, maintain that high level of global connectivity, that planetary empathy.
Without the massive carbon footprint.
You decouple progress from destruction.
It sounds beautiful. It sounds, frankly, it sounds utopian.
It does. It absolutely does.
And usually when things sound utopian, the implementation part is a complete disaster, which finally brings us back down to earth and back to De Reticular. Because they are not writing philosophy books. They are welding steel and writing code.
And that's the critical pivot from theory to practice. De Reticular is looking at Rifkin's blueprint and saying, okay, the centralized grid is failing. The entropy bill is coming due. We need to stop talking and start building the actual hardware that makes this third industrial revolution possible.
And their approach, the term they use in all their documents, is spherical resilience.
Which is a very fancy, marketing-friendly way of saying island mode.
Island mode. I love that term. It's so evocative.
It's a crucial concept in electrical engineering. Right now, our grid is painfully interconnected. If a major substation blows up in Ohio, the failure can cascade and take out power all the way to New York City.
We've seen it happen.
Island mode means a facility, say a hospital, a factory, or even a whole neighborhood, can detect a failure on the main grid, instantly sever its connection, and just keep running on its own local power generation.
So the rest of the world goes dark, but your lights, your servers, your machines, they all stay on.
Precisely. And De Reticular is building what they call the sovereign stack to make that island mode a permanent state, not just an emergency backup. They want to give you that civilization in a box we talked about.
So let's open up the box. The documentation breaks their tech stack into three distinct parts, which, not coincidentally, map perfectly to Rifkin's three pillars. We have the heart, the brain, and the motion.
Let's start with the heart. The energy source, the core of the system.
This is where I got stuck at first because I was expecting to read about solar panels and wind turbines. But De Reticular is partnering with a company called Agra.Energy, and they are using something called waste-to-energy plasma gasification.
This is a critical distinction, and it's probably their biggest technical advantage. Usually, when people hear waste-to-energy, they think of a big incinerator. You just pile up trash, bring it, and use the heat to boil water and turn a turbine.
Which is notoriously dirty.
It's dirty, it can release dioxins and other toxins, and nobody wants one built in their backyard. Plasma gasification is completely different physics. It doesn't burn the material in an oxygen-rich environment.
So what does it do?
It uses plasma torches, like superheated lightning bolts, to heat the waste material, things like hemp stalks, agricultural residue, even certain plastics, to incredibly high temperatures inside a low oxygen chamber.
How hot are we talking here?
Thousands of degrees Celsius. Hot enough to literally rip the molecular bonds of the material apart. It dissociates the molecules. So instead of getting smoke and ash, the solid matter is converted directly into a gas. They call it syngas.
Syngas.
Synthetic gas. It's mostly hydrogen and carbon monoxide. It's a clean burning fuel that you can then pipe into a standard generator to make electricity.
And what's left over from the original waste material, is there ash?
That's the most elegant part of the whole process. The only solid byproduct is something called biochar. It's basically pure, stable carbon. It's inert, it's sterile, and it happens to be an incredible fertilizer that sequesters carbon in the soil for hundreds of years.
So you take trash that would otherwise rot or be burned.
And you turn it into clean electricity and high-grade fertilizer. No smoke, no toxic ash.
And crucially, unlike solar, it works at night.
Exactly. This provides what engineers call baseload power. Solar is intermittent, the sun sets. Wind is intermittent, the wind stops blowing. But as long as humans are around, we will have waste. We will have trash. So you have a constant, reliable source of power. That is why they call it the heart. It beats 24/7.
Okay, so we have the heart beating away, providing constant power. Now we need the brain. And this is Rios.
The Rural Infrastructure Operating System.
I need to pause here for a second because I fell down a bit of a rabbit hole on this one. If you go and Google Rios, the first thing that comes up is a company that makes these very cool robotic arms for factories.
Yes, Rios Intelligent Machines. A fantastic company, but a completely different entity, no relation.
Right. It's an important clarification. DeRiticular's Rios is pure software. It's the operating system for the entire sovereign node. What does it actually do day to day?
It handles two massive critical tasks, what they call signal fusion and financial dispatch. Okay, let's take signal fusion first. What is that?
Imagine you are in that box in the middle of the jungle. You need internet, but you don't want to rely on just one single connection that might fail. Rios acts as a traffic cop for data. It takes in a Starlink satellite feed, a local 5G cellular signal, and maybe a low bandwidth LoRaWAN mesh network from nearby IoT devices, and it bonds them all together.
So it treats three different connections as one single fat pipe of data.
Exactly. It intelligently routes data packets in real time. If a storm cloud blocks the satellite signal for a few seconds, it instantly pushes all the critical data through the 5G connection without you ever noticing a glitch. It creates a resilient, unbroken stream of connectivity. Okay, that's signal fusion. What about financial dispatch? This sounds like the node itself is doing some day trading.
In a way, it is. The Rios brain is constantly monitoring a flood of data. It knows exactly how much power the agri unit is producing. It knows the current spot price of electricity on the national grid. It knows the value of processing AI data for a client. It knows the current charge level of the on-site batteries.
And it's making choices based on that data.
Constantly. Millisecond by millisecond, it's running an optimization algorithm. It asks, right now, is it more profitable for me to store this next kilowatt hour of energy in a battery? Should I sell it back to the main grid because prices just spiked due to a heat wave? Or should I use it locally to run the onboard GPU chips to process a machine learning task for a client in London? It's designed to maximize the economic profit of every single electron generated.
That is incredibly sophisticated. It's not just a generator anymore. It turns the entire piece of infrastructure into a dynamic, profit-seeking asset.
It financializes the infrastructure from the ground up.
Okay, so we have the heart providing power, the brain making decisions. That leaves the motion, the logistics layer.
Curb cars.
Curb cars.
Yeah.
With the K, of course.
Of course. These are basically small, autonomous electric rovers. Think of them as industrial-grade Roombas. If you have an eco-industrial park running in island mode, you still need to move physical things around. You need to move the biomass from the storage pile to the gasifier's hopper. You need to move the bags of biochar from the output to the warehouse. The curb cars are the worker ants of the system.
And I'm guessing they are electric, powered by the Agri unit.
And controlled by the Rios brain.
So it's a completely closed loop.
Hmm.
Energy, comms, logistics, the Rifkin trifecta, all in one integrated stack.
That's the vision.
And this isn't just a PowerPoint presentation. They're actually building this. Tell me about Project Octagon.
Project Octagon is their go-to-market and deployment strategy. They're in the process of building 8 of these strategic nodes in key locations around the world. The flagship, the one they talk about the most, is Node 4 in Uganda.
Why Uganda? What makes it the ideal test case?
It's the perfect storm of need and opportunity. Uganda has a huge agricultural sector, which means it has mountains of biomass, waste coffee husks, hemp stalks, you name it. But it also has a notoriously unreliable national grid infrastructure. So there's a huge supply of fuel and a huge demand for stable power.
And what is Node 4? Is it just one container?
No, it's a full-blown 7,000-acre eco-industrial park.
That is huge.
It is. They are using the plasma gasification units to provide reliable 247 power for local industries. They call it a green industrial engine. The idea is, instead of Uganda simply exporting raw coffee beans or raw hemp fiber for pennies on the dollar,
they can process it locally.
They can process it, package it, and manufacture finished goods right there using their own reliable, clean power. It allows them to capture more of the value chain.
So they keep the value in the local economy.
Exactly. It's a model that aims to break that old colonial dynamic of resource extraction.
But this all brings us to the biggest hurdle, the elephant in the room. Money. Capital. You can have the most brilliant technology in the world, but if you can't finance it, it's just a very expensive science project.
Yeah.
And this is where De Reticular's plan gets, well, it gets complicated.
It is complex, yes. But if it works, it's potentially revolutionary.
The sources keep bringing up this problem of dead capital. Who was it that coined that term?
That was Hernando de Soto, a brilliant Peruvian economist. His core thesis is that the poor in developing nations aren't actually poor in terms of assets. They have assets. They own land. They have crops. They run small businesses. But the problem is they have no formal legal title to any of it.
So they can't prove to a bank that they actually own the thing they say they own.
Right. And from a bank's perspective, an asset you can't legally verify is an asset that doesn't exist. So a banker looks at a farmer in rural Uganda who has a massive pile of hemp waste. The farmer says, "This is worth money. I can turn this into fuel." And the banker says, "I can't verify that pile exists from my office in Kampala. I can't grade its quality, and I have no legal mechanism to seize it if you default on a loan. To me, that capital is dead."
So the farmer stays poor because he can't get the loan he needs to buy the machine to turn the waste into value. It's a vicious cycle.
Exactly. And De Reticular's whole financial model is about using technology to bring that dead capital to life. The system they designed is called hemp-grade AI.
Okay, walk me through this step by step. How does a computer program turn a pile of dusty plant stocks into a bank loan?
It all starts at the physical Rios node. Remember, the node is packed with cameras and sensors. So the farmer brings his load of biomass to the Agra energy unit. As he loads it into the hopper, the computer vision system scans it in high resolution.
And what's it looking for?
It's grading it. It's analyzing moisture content, density, material type, looking for contaminants. It's algorithmically determining the energy potential of that specific batch of biomass. It then spits out a grade. Okay, this is 500 kilograms of grade A hemp biomass.
And then what happens?
Then the machine processes it. It gasifies it and turns it into a verifiable amount of energy. But here is the key technological leap that makes the whole thing work, solving what's known as the Oracle problem.
The Oracle problem. That's a classic crypto and blockchain term, right?
It is. In the world of blockchains, the chain itself is cryptographically secure. But the data that you feed into the blockchain from the real world is the weak link. If I have a smart contract that pays out based on the temperature, how does the contract know the real temperature? It relies on an oracle to tell it. And that oracle can be hacked or manipulated.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly. De Reticular's solution is something they call radio frequency fingerprinting. The actual hardware of the Rios node has a unique, verifiable electromagnetic signature, like a fingerprint. When it sends data to the network saying, "I just processed 500 kilograms of hemp and generated X kilowatt hours," the network can cryptographically verify that the signal physically came from that specific machine in Uganda and not from a hacker in a basement in Moscow trying to spoof the data.
So you have irrefutable physical proof of the work being done.
You have proof of industry. And once that proof is cryptographically established and timestamped, the system automatically mints a digital token, a bioenergy credit.
Okay, so now the dead capital, the pile of hemp, has been transformed into a digital token. But is it legal? Because my understanding is that for the last 2 years, the SEC has been on a warpath, nuking crypto projects left, right, and center.
And that, right there, is why the date 2026 is so critically important. The entire regulatory landscape in the United States has shifted dramatically because of two landmark pieces of legislation, the Genius Act and the Clarity Act.
Let's decode these because they're vital. First, the Genius Act.
It's a classic government acronym, Guidance in Establishing National Innovation for U.S. Stablecoins. It's a mouthful, but what it did was finally give federally chartered U.S. banks the green light to custody and transact with regulated stablecoins.
So a real bank, a BNY Mellon, a JP Morgan, can now hold and move digital dollars on a blockchain as a qualified custodian.
Yes, and that is a game changer. It allows DeReticular to partner with OCC-chartered national trust banks. They can issue loans to the farmers in Uganda in regulated, fully backed stablecoins. This completely removes the volatility risk for institutional investors. A big pension fund doesn't want to lend in Bitcoin because the price might crash 20% tomorrow. They want to lend in dollars. The Genius Act gave them safe, regulated digital dollars.
Okay, so that solves the currency problem. Now, what about the asset itself, the token? That brings us to the Clarity Act.
The Digital Asset Market Clarity Act, this one. This was the holy grail that the crypto industry had been begging for a decade. For years, the big fight was, is this crypto token a security, like a stock, which falls under the SEC? Or is it a commodity, like wheat or oil, which falls under the CFTC?
And why does that distinction matter so much to a guy on Wall Street?
It matters because the rules and regulations are completely different. Securities have massive, burdensome reporting requirements. You have to file quarterly reports with the SEC. You have to follow strict rules about who you can sell them to. It's heavy. Commodities, you just trade them. If you buy a barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude oil, you don't need to know the name of the guy who pumped it out of the ground. It's a bearer asset.
And Wall Street is built to trade commodities. They love the liquidity.
They love the liquidity and the simplicity. The Clarity Act finally established a clear legal test. It said that if you can prove a digital token represents a tangible physical good or service like a specific amount of energy or a verified ton of hemp and the network it runs on is sufficiently decentralized, then it is a digital commodity. It falls under the jurisdiction of the CFTC, not the SEC.
So DeReticular's proof of industry token
is a digital commodity by legal definition. Because their RF fingerprinting proves it represents real physical energy generated at a specific time and place. And this just unlocks the floodgates. It means pension funds, hedge funds, sovereign wealth funds, and global banks can now trade these tokens on regulated exchanges without the existential fear of the SEC showing up one day and shutting the whole thing down.
So let me trace the flow. The farmer in Uganda burns his agricultural waste. The Rios machine verifies the process physically. A digital commodity token is minted. And a hedge fund in New York or London can then lend against that token as collateral.
All through their platform, which they call the Sovereign Yield Protocol.
It sounds incredibly efficient, almost frictionless. But what about the risk for the lender? What if the farmer just stops working? What if the machine breaks down?
That's where the automatic liquidation feature comes in. It's a core part of the smart contract. The lending contract is connected directly, in real time, to the Rios node's data feed. If the node stops reporting power generation for a predetermined amount of time, if the heartbeat of the machine stops, the smart contract can automatically freeze the line of credit.
Instantly.
Instantly and autonomously. The lender is protected from default risk in a way that's just not possible in traditional finance. You don't need a court order. The physics of the machine enforce the terms of the loan.
It's ruthless efficiency.
It's the financialization of physics.
But, and I have to play devil's advocate here for a second, DeReticular is, at the end of the day, a startup. And they're trying to build power plants, write a complex operating system, and act as a decentralized central bank. That's an incredible amount to take on.
It is a massive undertaking. And historically, hardware startups die. They run out of money during the long, expensive process of research, development, and manufacturing. It's called the Valley of Death for a reason.
Right. It costs a lot of real money to bend steel and ship containers around the world.
It does. And the margins on hardware are notoriously thin. Maybe you make 20% on each unit you sell. You sell the box once, and that's it. Investors, especially venture capitalists, hate that model. They love SaaS software as a service. They want to see recurring revenue, 80% margins, sticky customers.
So this brings us full circle back to the pivot, the flood the Ford strategy.
This is their plan to escape that hardware trap. They came to the realization that they can't just be a company that sells fancy generators. They have to become a platform.
Like Apple and the App Store.
That is the perfect analogy. Apple makes the iPhone, which is a beautiful piece of hardware. But they don't make Uber or Instagram or TikTok. They create the platform and the tools, and they let a global army of developers build the value on top of their hardware.
So DRticular is trying to do the same thing. They're opening up the Raya's platform to outside developers.
They are. They're launching a big competition called Code Launch. They're essentially going to the developer community and saying, look, we've built this incredible sovereign node in the middle of the jungle. It has reliable power. It has resilient connectivity. It has onboard compute, and it has a built-in crypto wallet. Now, you build the apps that will change the world.
What kind of apps are they hoping for?
Anything you can imagine. A medical logistics app that uses the curb cars to autonomously deliver vaccines to remote clinics. A micro-insurance app for the farmers that automatically pays out based on weather data. A local payroll system for the factory workers that pays them in stablecoins directly to their digital wallets.
And DRticular just sits back, lets the ecosystem flourish, and collects a fee.
They license the Raya software to the node operators. But crucially, this strategy creates powerful vendor lock-in.
Oh.
Well, imagine a brilliant young developer in Nairobi builds a killer app for managing water resources in rural Africa. But that app is built specifically to run on Raya's. It relies on the unique features of the platform, the signal fusion for connectivity, the energy data from the Agri unit, the built-in sovereign yield protocol wallet.
So in order to run her app, a village or an NGO needs the DRticular box.
Exactly. Software sells the hardware. It's a Trojan horse. If a government wants that amazing water management app, they have to buy the DRticular node to run it on. It turns the hardware from a one-time sale into a mandatory delivery mechanism for high-margin software and services.
And that completely changes the valuation of the company from an investor's perspective.
Completely. There's a document in our sources here that talks about the Berkus method of valuation.
Right. Break that down for us.
The Berkus method is something investors use for very early stage companies that don't have revenue yet. Instead of looking at profits, you assign a monetary value to how much risk the founders have removed from the business. Do you have a sound idea? Check. Add $500,000 in value. Do you have a working prototype? Check. Add another $500,000. Do you have a quality management team that knows how to navigate these complex regulations? Check.
So you build up a floor valuation based on milestones.
Right. You get to a base valuation of maybe $2.5 million. But the real multiplier effect comes from the business model itself. A traditional hardware company might trade at maybe 2 or 3 times its annual revenue. But a SaaS platform company with recurring revenue and high margins, they can trade at 10, 15, even 20 times revenue.
So by making this pivot to the Flood the Forge strategy, they aren't just trying to get better apps for their users. They're actively trying to change their story to Wall Street and justify a much higher valuation.
They are trying to signal to investors, don't look at us as a gritty factory that makes generators. Look at us as a high-growth, high-margin tech company.
Which is incredibly smart if they can actually pull it off. But let's do a quick SWOT analysis here. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. What are the big threats? Because I can see a few massive ones on the horizon.
The biggest one, the one that kills most companies like this, is still capital intensity. Even with this clever software pivot, they still have to build the expensive physical nodes first to create the market for the developers. If they run out of cash before the app ecosystem takes off, they die in the valley of death. Game over.
And what about adoption on the developer side? Flood the Forge sounds cool in a press release, but what if the developers just don't show up?
That's the risk of adoption latency. If developers look at the Raya's platform and say, you know what, this is too hard to code for, or the market in rural Uganda is too small for me to bother with, then you have no apps. And if you have no apps, the hardware is just a very fancy, very expensive generator. It becomes what they call dumb pipes.
And then there is the giant 800-pound gorilla in the room. Big tech. The billionaires.
Starlink. Amazon.
Yeah. If Elon Musk wakes up one morning, looks at this model and says, wait a minute, I already own the satellite connectivity layer. I'll just slap a Tesla Powerwall battery on the ground, add a computer, and do this myself. What's to stop him? DRticular is cooked.
It's a massive existential threat. Starlink already has global connectivity dominance, but Dereticular's defense, their moat, is the deep vertical integration of the energy layer. Starlink doesn't have a solution for 247 baseload power from waste. They still rely primarily on solar, which is great for a house, but it's too intermittent for serious industrial applications.
So the secret sauce is the trash burning.
That and the privacy angle. The concept they call the data haven.
Explain what they mean by that.
We are seeing a slow motion fracturing of the global internet. People are calling it the splinternet. Countries like China, Russia, even parts of Europe are becoming increasingly uncomfortable with having all their critical data sitting on Amazon AWS servers in Virginia, where the NSA or the CIA might be able to look at it.
They want data sovereignty. They want to control their own data.
Exactly. A Dereticular node can operate completely offline. It processes data locally on the Rios chip inside the box. It's what you might call a zero-trust bubble. You could process sensitive medical data or government intelligence inside a node in Uganda, and it would never have to touch the public internet. It never leaves the sovereign territory of that box.
So it's a physical privacy vault that also generates its own power.
Precisely. Starlink, by its very nature, is a global interconnected mesh network. It's much harder for them to guarantee that level of absolute data isolation. Dereticular isn't just selling connectivity, they're selling sovereignty.
It's a very compelling pitch.
It is a very compelling story.
So, wow, we have covered a lot of ground here. We've gone from Jeremy Rifkin's high-level theory of converging internets all the way down to the molecular physics of plasma gasification. We've looked at the regulatory breakthroughs of the Genius and Clarity Acts and this really clever strategic pivot towards an app store model.
It's a remarkably comprehensive and integrated vision.
It is. But I want to zoom all the way out for our final thought. Dereticular is projecting, according to these internal documents, $78 million in revenue by 2028. They are pitching this to investors as a high-growth, venture-scale opportunity.
The next unicorn.
Right. But when you strip away all the buzzwords, all the spherical resilience and island mode and sovereign stack, what are they really truly selling?
At its core, they're selling insurance.
Insurance. Against what?
Against the systemic collapse of the complex systems we've all come to take for granted. Rifkin talks about entropy. He talks about how all complex civilizations eventually become fragile and buckle under their own weight and energy demands.
So Node 4 in Uganda, It isn't just a factory, it's a lifeboat.
It is. If the global supply chain snaps for good, if the dollar enters a hyperinflationary spiral, if the national grid goes down for a month, the people and the industries operating inside that sovereign node are fine. They have power, they have connectivity, they have a local economy, they have a functioning financial system.
It brings us right back to the beginning, to that biosphere consciousness idea.
Mm-hmm.
There's a deep irony here. We started by talking about a theory for saving the world. But the product they're building is a machine designed to help you survive the end of it.
That's the core paradox, isn't it? Is sovereign infrastructure a business model designed to fix and upgrade the existing global grid? Or is it a way for communities to peacefully secede from it before it falls apart completely?
And that is the question I want you, the listener, to chew on. In a world that feels increasingly shaky and uncertain, are we just looking for better, more efficient utilities?
Yeah.
Or are we, maybe secretly, all looking for an exit strategy?
Are you investing in a stock, or are you buying a ticket to the next civilization?
Deep thoughts for a Tuesday.
Thanks for diving in with us today. We'll see you on the next one. And stay sovereign.